Roll sound, Scotty.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Purple in the morning, blue in the afternoon, orange in the evening. Just like that. 1, 2, 3, 4.
You know, somebody like you can really make things all right for me.
You know what we need to do? We need to get us a piece of this Brody shit. Cut it up and off it.
Double our money, easy.
That's what I'm talking about, baby. No hassle.
You just watch my back, and I'll watch yours.
On our way, baby. On our way.
Hey, Ma, you want uppers?
You don't know. I'm gonna be on television.
Gotta win.
I'm somebody now, Harry. Everybody likes me. It's a reason to smile.
Let's do this right, man.
All I'm saying is we should take a little taste. We know how much to cut. It's business.
Fair enough.
Getting the money is not the problem, Harry. I don't know what I'm gonna have to do to get it.
This is our last chance to get back on track.
You promised me that everything was gonna be okay, remember?
I'm gonna be on television.
Showtime.
When are you coming home?
Soon.
Harry, can you come today?
I'm coming back, Marion.
It's the Stinking Paws podcast. Hi, Scott here. Now, today I'm not joined by Charlie, I'm not joined by Paul, but I'm joined by two equally wonderful friends of mine that have been podcasting for quite a while and joining in with numerous podcasts that we do here. First up, it's my co-host from Real Britannia, Stephen. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Excellent. And the man responsible for the choice of movie today, the host of Glass Onion on John Lennon, Life and Life Only, and Film Gold podcast, among many other things. It's Anthony. Hello, mate.
Hello, fellas, and the world. Saturday morning this time.
Saturday, and possibly not the best time of the week to be talking about this sort of movie or this particular movie. Could have been worse, could have been the Sabbath, but it's a bit weird talking about something this heavy at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Can I say, though, that Did you find it as tough to watch as you thought, maybe, apart from the last half an hour? No, it wasn't, was it? No.
I said to you guys, I've been putting this off because the only word that I'd heard associated with this film was, oh, my God, it's depressing. And when you hear that and you think, well, when am I ever going to be in the mood to watch a depressing movie? You need something like that to catch you out by surprise, like Grave of Fireflies, you know, which to me is still the sucker punch of the movies we've reviewed on Stinking Paws. That one hit me hard, you know, because I did know what was going to happen. And I went into this knowing that it was going to be a bit of a downer. But I think my sort of trepidation as to what to expect from the tone of the movie was overcome by the visual aspects of it and the sheer acting quality of one particular in person, but the whole cast, really. And the depressing element of it, yes, it did. That last 20 minutes was absolutely incredible. There was a letterbox review that I read that somebody literally was just a couple of sentences, and they put, you spend the first 20 minutes going, you spend the first 20 minutes not being able to take your eyes off the screen and saying, Darren Aronofsky, this is genius, well done. And then you spend the last 20 minutes not being able to take your eyes off the screen saying, fuck you, Darren Aronofsky, I can't take my eyes off this screen. And that summed up perfectly for me, because there is just this build up between the first 20 minutes and the last 20 minutes. It's a crescendo. It just builds and builds and builds. And I'm sort of taking over here, guys. I will let you chip in. But similar to Irreversible, it just overtakes all of your senses and you become totally immersed in what's going on that screen. And you just have to take a breath and sit back at the end of it and go, what the bloody hell did I just watch there? That was amazing. So there you go. That's my general thoughts on it.
I had a similar thought the day after I watched it, because I watched it Thursday yesterday. Mm. About that, you know, you are transfixed and not being able to take your eyes off the screen to begin with. And then there's a portion in the middle where you can't really look at the screen and you're watching it between your fingers thinking, oh, no, what are you doing? What's happening now? Where's this going? Oh. And you're thinking, this is where the descent happens. And you're just sort of thinking, this was, you know, why couldn't they, you know? And then it is the staring at like an accident. Having happened when you know rubbernecking or whatever. So yeah, absolutely agree with what you've said there.
So Anthony, you're the only one out of the three of us that has seen this before. So your impression of this is going to be slightly different, because Stephen and I have obviously gone into this and we've come out of this gobsmacked. You've gone in with a bit of forewarning, a bit of foreknowledge. Can you just tell the audience, is it Flickster or something, this thing that you judge your movies, you rate your movies against? What's this account thing you use where there's 150 odd films or something that you compare?
Flickchart,
that's it. Now, you sent me a text saying this has now skyrocketed up that chart, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it actually placed about 130 something, but I might go back, because a lot of those ones I have at the top, the Hitchcock in the 70s, to get that high up the list, the film probably has to be around for 30 years and sustain itself.
Right.
So this might be a bit too new, but yeah. No, I was absolutely blown away. Like, the first time I saw this, I think I had a memory of seeing it around the time, but not remembering it, which is quite strange. But I think at that time I was sort of just gobbling up films almost for the sake of it sometimes, you know, just to say that I'd seen it. But what happened was about 3 years ago now on Glass Onion, we did a review of a book called Riding So High, The Beatles and Drugs. And it's a really good even-handed look at how drugs had formed bonds, but then destroyed them, helped to destroy the band as well.
Right.
And during it, I asked my guest, I said, oh, should we make a list of sort of drug films and drug albums to see like what good ones have come out? And then he mentioned Requiem for a Dream, and I thought, I got confused, because there's a Noam Chomsky documentary called Requiem for the American Dream. I think I'd watched that. I'd got them confused, but yeah, I was really blown away. And I noticed how much similarity there was to Trainspotting? It's a bit of an American Trainspotting, but honestly, I thought it was as good, if not better. I don't know.
Right, you mentioned that in your text as well, and yes, yeah, so I was looking out for sort of like similarities, and obviously some of the hallucinogenic side of things, and seeing it from, you know, the drug taker's point of view, and I just picked up my copy of what's it called, the 1001 Movies to See Before You Die book this morning, just to see what they had to say about it. And there is a comparison. Let me just read this, right? Visually, Requiem owes much to both Danny Boyle's Trainspotting and the films of Spike Lee. You can see that as well, actually, the interaction between people. But unlike Boyle, whose own drug movie included sequences of hallucinogenic subjectivity, Aronofsky resists grounding the audience in any kind of objective position. The entire film is shot within this drug-addled subjective tense. You only see it from the point of view of the person that's taking the drugs. That whole thing where the camera is strapped to the front of the actor's body and they're running, you know, the scene where they're running away from the robbery, or the bit where Jennifer Connelly comes out and she's actually throwing up into the camera almost as well. Yeah. It's so disorientating, but you know, we've seen it in 1,000 different pop videos. I think there's a Bjork video that uses it, isn't there? I think, and that is the similarity to Trainspotting to me. But then also with Danny Boyle, he snaps you out of that by giving you a vision of, no, this is actually what's going on. You know, Renfield, whatever his name is,
Renton.
You know, the hallucinations in the toilet or the baby on the ceiling and all that lot. But he snaps you out of it from Renton's point of view. You don't get that luxury in this film because the agony stays with you and you suffer with each and every character in this movie.
Well, what I was thinking, it's not that it's similar. It's not similar in the details and the tone to Trainspotting, but there are a few of the same things, like having this dance music going, you know, that really propels everything. And then there was some stuff at daytime TV, because that's in Trainspotting, you know, when Renton's withdrawing at the end.
Yeah.
And you get that horrible, sense of mind-numbing daytime TV, you know, that could really, I mean, that's just an awful, that's the worst trip if you get stuck. I have been unemployed before. I don't know if you've ever had this. And during the day, you've got daytime TV and it's just killing your soul, just slowly but surely. I think that our culture has moved on a bit from just saying, you know, just say no and say, oh, no, all drugs are bad, kids. Mm-hmm. I think this film, like Trainspotting, it does show at the beginning that drugs are fun for the people and that, you know, it's not so clear cut as maybe our parents or, you know, previous generations thought. But then they show you that it all falls apart, just like Trainspotting. So it's no promotion of drugs, but you've got to understand why people do it, you know, that it can be fun.
It's also, sorry, Steph, I was going to say, also at the heart of it is the fact that you mentioned the American dream, you know, and it is the fuel to attain that goal of the American dream. You know, Ellen Burstyn's character, her dream is to appear on TV. How's she going to get there? She's got to lose weight. How's she going to lose weight? Diet pills, you know, and that's the thing. And I didn't realize until watching it last night, you know, I just dismissed the title of the movie, Requiem for a Dream, but it is the American dream, isn't it, from all four characters, that each of them all gets all their, you know, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations all get shattered because of their drug use.
And there's that point where they always say about drug addiction, when you're working the drug around your life, it's not so bad, but when you start working your life around the drug, you see there's that tipping point.
You can see the tipping point in all the characters as well.
Absolutely. It's halfway through the fall. Because I think the thing with the three seasons, it could have been really clunky, but it's three acts of a story, isn't it, basically?
Yeah.
You know, and it's halfway through the fall section, which is about halfway through the film. You just gradually start to see, you know, they start arguing, Harry and Marion. And you gradually see that switch happening. And that's it. And then, lucky as well.
And the fridge comes to life as well at this particular point. Steve, go on, mate.
I was just going to say, I mean, there's part of this that is not so much about chasing a dream, but chasing escape. That, you know, all the characters are wanting to really escape in one sense or another. Obviously, Ellen Burstyn is wanting to escape the humdrum dead, you know, life where nothing is happening, and hers is centred around being on TV. Is that escape, is attainment for, you know, and Jennifer Connelly's, you know, trying to escape from a privileged background ultimately into something else, and then the others trying to, you know, escape from what is unfortunately the reality of the American dream, where at best you're going to be doing some monotonous job for minimum wage and not being able to have any attainment of dreams. And this, I think the focus is more so for me, it's about addiction rather than drug taking as such. Because of that, you know, initially there's an addiction to TV, and there's, you know, other ways in which there's that crutch of what people try to do to try and rely upon or try to use to escape, and what they're initially relying upon just to escape what is unfortunately the modern world, which is not fulfilling for any of the people at the start of the film, and even less so towards the end.
Yeah. While you're saying that, I was thinking this is just before the opportunity to be an internet entrepreneur happened, of course, didn't it? Because this is 2000. Obviously, the internet had arrived, but yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah, but it tries to be a bit vague about the time setting it's put in.
Right.
I think from thinking back over it, I don't think it had anything that was really in your face with regards to what time period it was set in. I think, you know, the cars were old and for their time possibly, and therefore it gives you a possibility of being set anywhere in the decade previous to when it was actually filmed potentially, or even at some point in the 80s. But yeah, there's not a lot of modern stuff technology wise at the time to, I think, separate it slightly.
The giveaway is the new TV, I think, because, you know, the TV is almost the character in this movie as well, being wheeled away on the trolley. But that's a proper typical 60s, 70s old clunky tube TV. Then all of a sudden, Jared Leto buys his mother the big screen TV with the surround sound system and all of that lot. So it sort of places it into a time zone. But there's no other giveaway, Stephen. You're absolutely right. Even the clothing, I don't think, is too, you know, much of a giveaway.
Well, I was thinking the self-help stuff.
Mm.
But self-help's actually a bit older than we think. I think self-help started in the 60s and 70s, but that was kind of a Jerry Springer style. Well, it was Tony Robbins, wasn't it? Tony Robbins, I suppose, as well. I was going to say, that self-help thing, they made it look so sinister, which I thought was brilliant. All that
cult. It looked like a cult.
Yeah, that was it. And funnily enough, when I was very young, it was probably about 21, 22, I moved up to Leicester with my then girlfriend. And I actually had a job doing door-to-door. It wasn't double glazing, you'll be pleased to know, or drugs. So. No, I did this door-to-door thing, and when I joined this place, they used that acronym, JUICE. Do you remember that? Join us in creating excitement. And when I got to the place, it looked like everyone had majorly been indoctrinated into it, because people were going around the building going, JUICE, like, even when no one had told them to do it, you know. Obviously, they did all the chanting, you know, JUICE, JUICE, JUICE. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, but he really captured how sinister that can be.
Sounds like you had a lucky escape.
who said he did escape? Yes. Isn't this joining us in creating the enjoyment?
Scott Phipps he's
sitting there wearing the robes now. the acting in this is phenomenal.
Yes. Can we talk about Ellen?
We've got to. I mean, we'll talk about the others as well at some point. But I had seen Erin Brockovich, which is the movie that came out the same year, and Julia Roberts won Best Actress. Okay.
That was my heart sinking, if you could hear that.
Yes, I heard the clunk there. And I like Erin Brockovich, and I like Julia Roberts' performance in it, but I had nothing to compare it to until last night.
Yeah.
And as somebody pointed out, it might have been Roger Ebert, he said, fair enough, Julia Roberts gave the best performance of her career in Erin Brockovich, quite rightly, blah, blah, blah. He said, but so did Ellen Burstyn, you know. And when you put the two of them together, there's no comparison.
I mean,
it should have gone to Burstyn, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Julia Roberts, I don't know. I haven't seen Erin Brockovich in a while, but it seemed like she was playing that character she plays, but slightly better.
Mm.
You know, that kind of sassy but slightly vulnerable Julia Roberts character. Mm-hmm.
It's a good film. I mean, Albert Finney's in it, and it's you know, it's quite one of those true story sort of things. But after watching this last night, I'm thinking, oh, somebody was robbed at the Oscars that year. And it's the whole, it's the physical performance as well as the actual acting itself. You know, her whole physical demeanor changes. Obviously, she must have had some sort of weight added to her, like some sort of fat suit type thing at the beginning.
Fat suits, and I think I read that there was prosthetics used for the neck as well, like three different.
Glad you said fat,
and then, you know, showing it more withdrawn
and
emaciated, and then apparently there's about a dozen different wigs used as well.
It's just a whole transformation, and it's not sudden. You know, each scene, there is a gradual difference in her.
Mm.
Even the close-ups, when they're just looking at her face and she's just twitching and sweating.
Oh,
and
yeah. And when she's sort of sitting, keeping eyeing the fridge, isn't she? Because she's hungry, near the beginning. She's eyeing the fridge and just, like you say, they're twitching. But obviously a lot of it is the camera work, but the way she's looking, near the beginning, I think she's looking at the fridge, you know, she's looking at some food. And she's just got this sort of, slightly guilty, but... She very much does these childlike looks, doesn't she? Like right near the beginning, yeah. when she's looking at the TV and imagining herself on the TV, you know, she does this smile like she could be a girl, you know, a little girl. She's so good at that. And what happened was it?
Go. No, sorry, I was going to say she makes the effort at the beginning because what she's sort of angry at the fridge for is she's got a fridge full of food. Mm. But she's forced herself to go on one of those fad diets at the time, yeah. Which was the grapefruit and egg and black coffee diet. That was an actual thing.
Mm.
And you know, she knows she's got a fridge full of food. And it's not until about halfway through where the amphetamine really kicks in and she's doing all the housework and scrubbing the floors. Mm. You see her emptying the fridge into a black bag.
Yeah.
And then obviously the fridge turns against her because it's empty or whatever, you know, whatever she's thinking. But yeah, sorry, mate.
No, but the way the camera's done and everything, it just works perfectly with what she's doing. But I think actually with Darren Aronofsky, I think had seen The Exorcist, or he must have seen other stuff that she'd done. And it was one of those occasions, a bit like when Tarantino revived people's careers, you know, Travolta, obviously, Kurt Russell and other ones, David Carradine. And she'd been doing a lot of stage work, so she was very good, you know, stage-trained actors, they're very good at that, holding positions and being able to concentrate for long periods, you know, when the camera's on your face and stuff. And Darren Aronofsky said there were about three occasions in the film where you just felt her, like, completely lose herself in the character, you know. Probably the scene where she's saying, this is my reason for getting up. Do you remember she says that there's no other reason why I wake up, just the idea of being on telly. But can I ask you a quick question? Because I wasn't sure about this. Was the initial approach, did the TV show actually call her at the beginning? She didn't hallucinate that, did she?
No, because she went to the studio. Is that right, Stephen? And they, or were they just being...
She gets a phone call.
She does get a genuine phone call.
She gets a phone call and she thinks it's telemarketing. And she's like, oh, I'm not interested. And they're going, no, we're not trying to sell you anything. You've already won. Yeah. You know, and that's where it comes across. And then subsequently she's waiting for it. She gets some paperwork through, so it isn't just a few hallucinations because she filled that out with her friend. So it's not just her imagining
it out.
And then that gets sent off, and then subsequently, because there's no follow-up from the TV people, that's when, you know, she ends up, you know, obsessing over it, and then to the stage where she does go to the studio and never really comes back.
Do you think the idea is that they send that to just thousands of people, so you're on a very, very long shortlist, and the chances of actually getting there are very small, so it's just to make you probably keep watching the programme, isn't it? Is that...
Basically. Absolutely. Well, if you have such suspicions of the you know, TV executives and program makers that they are just, you know, treating the audience so shoddily,
I'm a conspiracy theorist,
then you know, you think they don't actually care about their audience?
No, they care passionately about them.
Not like we care about our listeners.
I was about to say, where are you going with this?
Yeah. Juice! Come on, audience! Juice. Be excited! Be excited!
Yeah, the sales pitch that Anthony will do at the end, trying to sell Stinking Paws audience.
Stinking Paws! Yeah.
We'll come up with an acronym for it at some point during the show. Ellen Burstyn wasn't first choice.
Oh,
I just read. It was Faye Dunaway, wasn't it? I think I read.
Faye Dunaway was one of them. There was somebody else as well. I think there's three other people mentioned.
Yeah, or she was, and she turned it down initially because of the depressing nature of it. It was only when her agent showed her Pi, which was Aronofsky's first movie, that she agreed to do it. I'm sure I read it was Faye Dunaway. Stephen, you're normally pretty good on the castings of things, aren't you?
Faye Dunaway was one of the people who was offered. And I do, you know, despite what I just said there, I think you're right that originally Ellen Bernstein was offered it and turned it down, and then it was offered to a number of other people. Faye Dunaway being one of them. I'm trying to remember who the other one was. There was another one as well that name's gone out of my head. They were offered it subsequently, but also turned it down. And thankfully, because they did, it left the opening for Ellen Bernstein to come back, and then obviously had this fantastic performance, which, you know, I can't imagine really anybody doing it better, because it was so outstanding. Yeah.
Yeah, if they'd done a British version, they might have got someone like Barbara Windsor, wouldn't they? That could have gone Carry On Requiem.
You know who it would be? It'd be Helen Mirren. It's always Helen Mirren.
Yeah. It's not...
Or Judy Dench.
Yeah,
Judy Dench.
Or who's the other one? Maggie Smith, yeah. Helena Bonham Carter. There you go. Yeah. I guess she wasn't even middle-aged.
Julie Walsh, would
Joan Sims.
Related to John Sim and
Alistair Sim. That's the running gag of the Real Britannia podcast, isn't it? Yeah, the Sim clan. None of them are related whatsoever, but we've got them.
We haven't even got the same surname, some of them. Some of them it's Sim, some of them it's Sims, some of them it's Tip Double M, some of it isn't.
Yeah, they're one big family in our hearts, though, aren't they?
Where were we?
What is the big deal about being on television? Those pills you're taking will kill you before you ever get on, for Christ's sake.
Big deal? You drove up in a cab. Did you see who had the best seat? I'm somebody now, Harry. Everybody likes me. Soon, millions of people will see me and they'll all like me. I'll tell them about you, your father. How good he was to us. Remember? It's a reason to get up in the morning. It's a reason to lose weight. To fit in a red dress. It's a reason to smile. It makes tomorrow all right. What have I got, Harry? Why should I even make the bed or wash the dishes? I do them. But why should I? I'm alone. Your father's gone. You're gone. I got no one to care for. What have I got, Harry? I'm lonely. I'm old.
You got friends, Ma?
It's not the same. They don't need me. I like the way I feel. I like thinking about the red dress and the television and you and your father. Now when I get the sun, I smile.
I checked out the awards. Now, obviously, we just spoke about Ellen Burstyn being robbed for the Best Actress. This wasn't even nominated for Best Editing. Not even a nomination. Now, I thought that would have been a shoo-in, because that use of split screen initially, I'm thinking, okay, that's fine. You know, it's something a little bit different. Or thinking, oh, we've seen this before. Where's he going with it? But that then develops into this thing where he's doing the close-ups and then he's doing this sharp cutting. I love that bit. You know, every time they take a hit with Ellen Burstyn, it's the slurp of the coffee, the undoing of the pill bottle, or when it goes over to Jared Leto or whatever, it's the rolled up dollar bill, it's the sniffing of the powder, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And it's that and it has its own sort of music to it. It's almost like its theme tune. There's Ellen Burstyn, chuk, slish, boom, boom, whatever. And I just love that. And I just looked up somewhere, again, it's just jumped out of me. I think it might be Wikipedia. There were something like 2,000 or 3,000 cuts in this movie, where the average movie of this length only had something like 700.
Yeah. Well, towards the end, that final fast cutting. Oh, can you imagine how long that would have taken? Just that alone.
It adds to the unease, doesn't it? As I say, this whole crescendo that's building up, and the pace of that gets busier and busier. Mm. And just before Ellen Burstyn peaks and crashes, it's just relentless.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. There's this lovely sweet spot of about 10 minutes where you can just see everything going. You know, the bit where Jennifer Connelly turns against Jared Leto, as you said, mate. Yeah. The bit where Ellen Burstyn rings up the doctor and says, these pills aren't working. And they said, no, you're getting used to them. That's all it is. That's quite normal. So then she starts taking them in a different combination, or taking two at a time.
Yeah.
And then you see the smile on her face as it kicks in again.
Oh, yeah. It's that girly, yeah. That kind of girlish smile, isn't it? That mischievous, slightly guilty look that she has on her face.
Yeah. She ends up going back to the doctor to talk about the prescription. And he said, no, that's fine. But it's all filmed in that, like, fishbowl lens, yeah, as well, looking down on her. So you get this constant disorientation because, as we said earlier, it's from the perspective of the person that's taking the drugs at the time,
yeah,
not looking at them. And it's just great from that point of view. It did unease me. It didn't unease me as much as, I say, Irreversible did. That just made me feel physically sick. You know, we spoke about the constant humming of the background noise and you know, the swinging camera and all of that lot. This just made me feel uncomfortable in a different way.
Mm.
But as I said, it wasn't the focus for my brain while I was watching it. I was just enthralled by all of that editing and all of that cinematography and the acting all the way through.
Yes, an astounding piece of, you know, the camera work and editing and et cetera, obviously, you know, a big part of this film, but the performances in themselves are quite raw in a lot of ways, and the way they do portray the things with such intensity that gives you the inner view in some respects, despite the camera work showing, like you just said, like an almost CCTV, you know, exterior view, then the actual acting showing the interior, the balance between the two, which is, you know, disjointed in itself, actually all just adds to this film.
Yeah, I listened to the commentary, and he was saying something I hadn't noticed, that at the beginning of the film they use a lot of natural light, like the sun shining through the window or something, and then as it goes on, it gets more and more artificial, and they're sort of inside, and you've got electric light. I thought that was a good touch.
There's no windows in Jared Leto's apartment.
Yeah, yeah.
If you notice, just going back to that as well, I think Jennifer Connelly's downfall is just as crashing as Ellen Burstyn's.
Yeah, it's just different, isn't it? Yeah.
Because when you see her at the beginning, she looks almost like a teenager. You know, where they're running up to the roof and they're breaking out into the roof where they fix the alarm so they can get out through the lift. And when you compare that character to the point where you get the desperation, and the anger, where Jared Leto hasn't provided what she wants, and you think, hang on a minute, an hour ago you were this sweet, lovable, cute sort of like girlfriend of this guy, you have turned into an animal. This has absolutely changed you. Yeah.
And then the way she's making herself up, you know, in you know, the darkness of her makeup, and the way she's making, you know, doing her appearance and the desperation therefore to go to the not quite right term to call it a party, but you know, that is absolutely the counterpoint to all of them having their own downfall, and you know, unfortunately, some of them are more likely to be able to exit that probably with help in future, rather than some of them that there's never going to be an escape.
Yeah, Ellen Burstyn's permanently. Well, I think a thing on Wikipedia they said she's in a catatonic, near vegetative state at the end. But what about the scene? I did feel ashamed to do this, but I watched the ECT scene from Cuckoo's Nest to use my phrase, that looks like a tea party now compared to this. That moment, oh, that moment is just, oh God. You just think the poor woman.
I'm sitting on the edge of my seat waiting for that third blast. I was literally feeling the pain there.
Yeah.
But it's sort of cut amongst all the other scenes of downfall amongst the other characters as well. So, you know, you'll get the first like shock of the ECT, then it will cut to Jennifer Connelly putting on her makeup or it might actually be at the party at this point. You've got the bit where Jared Leto is being rushed to the hospital to have his arm amputated. And the Marlon Wayans character, what's the relationship with his mum? What was the downfall of the dream there that, you know, I could see like Jared Leto wanted to, you know, make money and be successful. Jennifer Connelly wanted the business of the clothes designing. Ellen Burstyn wanted to appear on TV. Mm. What was the relationship with the Marlon Wayans? Because it all flashed back to his mother, didn't it? The cuddle that he had with his mum.
Yeah, we didn't see his mother in the present, did we? He had a girlfriend, didn't he? We saw his girlfriend. Yeah, it was just, I don't know, I suppose it was a little bit vague, but it was just, yeah, thinking back, maybe his mother had died and his was all about proving himself. That he's like a worthy son or something.
I become somebody, yeah.
But right. I only knew him from... we could talk about the cast, maybe, couldn't we? But I only knew him from Scary Movie. He's basically a comedy... I think he's a comedy actor, but he's like very convincing.
It's the Wayans family, isn't it? It's, there's a few of them that have gone on to bigger and better things, yeah, but...
Yeah, that was kept vague, yeah. He was talking about... Maybe he thought he hadn't been a good son or something, you know?
Yeah. He pushed and pushed in order to be in this film because of having seen, like the rest of them, you know, deciding that on the basis of Pi, the film obviously, going down the line, you know, then wanting to be in it and apparently, you know, read the book multiple times and pushed a number of interviews and tried to campaign to get the role because it wasn't offered to him first. It was Dave Chappelle that was first offered.
Right.
I found my notes I made about the alternative casting now. Yeah, Dave Chappelle for the Wayans character. Neve Campbell was an alternative.
That would have worked.
But
she
refused to do it because of the nudity. Jared Leto wasn't the first offer, and it was Tobey Maguire.
And Giovanni Ribisi, I think, got offered
and Giovanni Ribisi, yeah. And the other person I was trying to remember for the alternative to Ellen Burstyn was Anne Bancroft.
That would,
which I think would have worked.
That would have worked.
Yeah. Might not have been, you know, as good as Julie Walters or Barbara Windsor, but still.
Or Joan Sims, yeah.
Joan Sims.
Yeah, I think thinking about that with the Ellen Burstyn. It could be a role that's not going to do your career that much good, you know, because she saw Pi, yeah. Did you see that thing where she was saying, I watched 10 minutes and I said, all right, this guy's an artist. And she took the part, but it was quite risky, I think. Could have come out really cartoonish, you know.
Ben!
Where the hell do you think I've been, huh?
Where's the score?
Well, we had a little bit of a problem, see? I mean, everything was going good, and then some dumbass junkie...
Some dumbass junkie did what? You mean you fucked it up?
What the fuck is wrong with you?
You promised me that everything was gonna be okay, remember? I fucked that sleazebag for you, and I put myself through fucking hell for you!
There's nothing out there!
I don't give a shit! You fucking loser!
Be sure we have some extra stuff.
Ty told me about a guy
that's holding some weight. But he ain't selling it!
Yeah.
Yeah, Ty, give me that guy's number.
What guy?
Yeah, the guy who likes broads.
Victor,
just give me the fucking number for Christ's sake.
934-8777.
You worried so goddamn much? Here, go fix yourself up with him. You won't have to fucking wait around so much. And I won't have to freeze my ass off in the fucking streets!
One thing I noticed at the end, the very, very end...
Which end? Because it's a double end.
um, they all assume a fetal position.
Yeah, yes. I love that, yeah.
And it didn't hit me until after the credits rolled, you know, that because I was sort of so caught up in everything else that was going on. I'm thinking, oh, they're all actually... Because as Marlon Wayans does it, his mother is sort of superimposed covering him.
Yeah.
Jennifer Connelly's clutching the stash of it's the clothing designs, isn't it, I think, that she's holding on to.
She's holding her stash, isn't she?
Yeah, but she's...
But she's got the clothing designs. Surrounded,
yeah.
Yeah. Strewn around the room.
All that lot. Mm. And obviously, Jared Leto's just lost his arm and he curls up in the bed, as does Ellen Burstyn with after going through the electric shock treatment. It's just incredible, you know, this visual bits and pieces. And normally with a film this depressing, I would say, do you know what? I never, ever want to see that again, because it just created so much emotion and tension within me while I was watching it. I am going to rewatch this fully prepared this time round. And I think I'm going to have the same reaction that you had, Anthony, in the fact that, you know what, I'm just going to appreciate this tenfold now. It's amazing film. I've dismissed this film for the last 20 years, just thinking, oh, yeah, it's fine. It's, yeah, one of those depressing movies. I've got no need to watch that. I bloody have, and I did, and I'm glad I did.
That fetal thing you're saying, yeah, that's interesting, because in a funny way, if you take it literally, it's almost a happy ending, in the sense that literally the last shots, the at least three of the characters have a weird kind of smile on their face, don't they?
They're all at peace.
And I don't know about you, but every time I watch this, I mean, I've only seen it three times, but you just want to save Ellen Burstyn, just saying, oh, I wish I could do something to help, but because it's just... It's sadly inevitable. But there was a really interesting shot at the end where two of her friends are comforting each other, which you could take a couple of ways. It could be that they're comforting each other because of what's happened to her, but they could be a bit almost self-indulgent as well.
Yeah. Well, one of them, I think, was the lady who had initially put her onto that diet thing, because it had been her niece or whatever that had gone down that line. So it might be one of them comforting the other to say, you know, it's not entirely your fault.
That's an actress called Louise Lasser.
Yes.
And I think she had some association with Woody Allen, might have been an ex-girlfriend of Woody Allen's, but Stephen might remember this. Stephen, the early days of Channel 4, right?
Yeah.
The Friday night slot that was sort of taken over by Cheers and Roseanne and all of those American comedies.
Yeah.
There was one, and I think it only lasted one season. It was called Mary Hartman.
Rings a bell.
And it was sort of a... You'd probably love this, Anthony, because what I remember of it, it was a bit surreal. And it was like a 30-minute sitcom. But it was also, I think, almost a spoof of the soap operas at the same time. But it was set, I think, in sort of Hicksville, USA sort of thing. Mm. I don't remember too much about it, but it was a sitcom. And I'm pretty sure it didn't have a laughter track as well, which was always a bit disorientating, because you watch a sitcom with no laughter track and you think, am I supposed to laugh here? Was that funny or whatever? But some sitcoms work without a laughter track. MASH absolutely works without a laughter track, as far as I'm concerned. But Louise Lasser, I'm sure she appeared in some early Woody Allen's. I'm just trying to have a little look.
She did, yeah. Take the Money and Run, Bananas. She was basically the love interest before Diane Keaton and before Mia Farrow.
There we go.
She was married to him, yeah.
Friday night thing, yeah, I think it was, if I remember correctly now thinking back on it, I think it's something that was maybe a bit more experimental and would have actually been a massive hit if it had been done like 5 years later. Maybe, you know, in some ways the parody element of it, or the not quite spoof, but the way it's homaging in a playful way, I think maybe didn't hit the zeitgeist at the time, but would have worked later. So
the world wasn't ready for it, basically.
Yeah.
She got banned from Saturday Night Live as well. Very early days of Saturday Night Live. I can't remember what it was. She was arrested for something. And it was a real scandal. But yeah, she sort of had a great career throughout the 70s.
Is this Louise Lasser we're talking about?
I'm sure there was something that happened during one of the very early episodes of Saturday Night Live. She was asked to host or appear or something, and she got, you know, like refused to, you know, they refused to let her back on. I'll have to look into this because it's quite an interesting character. And you don't see much of Louise Lasser in anything now or since. Mm. So I recognised the face immediately, and I had to look it up to check the name when I was watching it last night.
Another one of Sarah's friends, yeah, they're kind of clucking hens, you might call them.
Yeah.
One of the bank tellers in Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, was
apparently.
It?
I don't know if it's the main one who sort of befriends Al Pacino in that film, but one of them.
Oh,
yeah.
Brilliant. And I like the bit, and it sort of reminded me of an Anderson movie where all of them are sitting out on their deck chairs in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is sort of the Spike Lee comparison as well, you know, in that sort of part of New York or whatever. But I just thought, oh, is this going to go down that sort of road where it's going to be these arty-farty shots of, you know, these wide shots of people all in rows and chairs? And, but it didn't.
Thank God.
Did anybody notice, talk to the cast, there was two cast members from The Thing?
The Thing? Oh, that was in the...
Yeah. Yeah, Carpenter. John Carpenter.
Oh, well, obviously, brilliantly sleazy Keith David. One of two amazingly sleazy characters. Yeah, the other one's a psychiatrist. Tin. Yeah.
Yeah, the doctor, the pill doctor, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I know it's pretty, baby, but I didn't whip it out just to give it some air, something like that.
And what's his face? Hubley, the author of the book, I think, plays a cop.
He's the racist cop when Marlon Wayans is in jail drying out. Yeah.
Now, he wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn, didn't he? This is the other...
Yeah.
Yeah? Which, now, I'm trying to remember. It was made into a film, I think, the 80s. Was it Jennifer Jason Leigh?
She could have done this as well. That would have been a good
I always get it mixed up with Drugstore Cowboy, but I think Last Exit to Brooklyn was Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah, and
not Matt Dillon, is it? Because that's Midnight Cowboy, Midnight whatever it was, Drugstore Cowboy.
For some reason, I remember that Sam Rockwell's in it.
Is he? Very young Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, Burt Young, who's Paulie out of Rocky, he's in it. Alexis Arquette, oh my God. Stephen Lang, who's now sort of got a career as an action hero. Stephen Baldwin's in it.
Stephen Baldwin.
The lesser of the Baldwins.
the lesser of many things.
Yeah, lesser than Mike Baldwin, obviously.
Yeah. Exactly. Mike Baldwin is probably Mike Baldwin's further up the pecking order than Stephen Baldwin. anything else anybody want to add, because there is so much to say, yet at the same time we can't really do this film justice just by talking about it. It's just amazing.
Well, with the casting, Ellen Burstyn has been on the stinking paws. I don't know if you've done The Exorcist, but
we've done The
Exorcist. She's in a film that's got a really interesting scene about bees. Can you imagine, remember that was The Bees? What's the film? The Bees.
I was going to say The Wicker Man.
Yeah, she was in the remake of The Wicker Man, apparently.
Oh, was she? Yeah. I can't remember. That film was so awful. Yeah. I forgot Ellen Burstyn. She's actually, there's a trailer out now for the remake, the sequel to The Exorcist.
Oh, right.
Being released this Halloween.
Oh, right.
Part six, or is it part seven of the prequels?
A direct sequel to the original. She plays obviously the same character, and she gets brought in because two girls have been possessed, and because she had some experience back in 1971, they turn to her, you know. I hope it's going to be okay, but I've got this real sinking feeling.
A sequel because they've gone and ramped it up by having two girls rather than one.
Exactly. Yeah.
With the cast here, Jared Leto, I've forgotten he was in Fight Club, and he was in American Psycho as well. I think he's the first person he kills. Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
With the business. But something else, Jared Leto was in a film called Chapter 27. Have you ever seen that?
That is supposed to be one of the worst movies ever made. Is that the one I'm
Maybe,
thinking?
Maybe, yeah. Who did he play in that, Scott? I can't remember. Who was it?
Oh, is it going to be a Beatle, perchance?
He did play Mark David Chapman, a very unfortunate reference, because he's John Lennon's killer, yeah. It's just too easy. Oh, it's just too easy, isn't it? You know, I went to Jared Leto's filmography. Too easy.
Yeah, I forgot the Beatles reference thing that we do here, and I'm just trying to think if there's anything else now.
He's already done it at least once.
Sometimes you have to look for them, and sometimes they just pop up, you know, like magic.
It's easier
when me and Scott notice them before you.
Yeah, that has happened. Yeah.
It's easier when we were on Real Britannia, because a British movie has more chance of having a Beatles connection than an American one, I think, sometimes.
Well, obviously, but there's a drug connection, but that's a bit too vague, probably.
Yeah. Talking of Beatles, talking of the music, you mentioned, you know, the Trainspotting sort of relentless sort of dance music. What about the sort of string quartet stuff that was going on in the background? I thought that was great as well. That worked.
Yeah, well, the idea
especially the way it started. The way it started at the beginning of the film, when you're almost getting like the tuning up of the orchestra and
they're getting ready for the funeral mass.
That I think sets you up for the, you know, it's a nice touch the way the film comes in with the music, and it is very, you know, trying to play it out that all of this happens within the course of a Requiem score, with it coming to the, you know, the end, and that's the way it works. I think rather than it being that it restarts or anything like that, I think that's the way they've nicely played in with the strings.
Well, that main theme is played at the beginning of each season, isn't it? They sort of go back to that main theme. Was that main theme that was original to the composer, wasn't it? That's just sounded so familiar.
I think so, because the quartet themselves get a reference right at the beginning of the movie at the credits. And I started, you know, immediately I thought, oh, I've got to listen out for that, because if they've highlighted the music quite prominently at the beginning of the film, that's going to be an important part of the movie. And when it kicked in, I thought, oh, I can see why now. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a funny mixture, isn't it? Because some of it looks a bit like, the film looks a bit like a music video at times, but in a good way, not in a cheesy way. So there's a kind of slightly, I don't know if it's hip hop or dance element. And then you've got this music right at the beginning. This is weird. That first scene where there's a split screen of Ellen Burstyn and Jared Leto. They play this little bit that sounded quite a bit like The Exorcist. Just for a second. Did you hear that?
Spotted that. Yeah. Yeah, I spotted that and I thought, hang on
that
a minute.
That looks like
where's
a sort of direct
trick.
Yeah.
Little homage there. I did hear that. Absolutely.
But just brilliant. And the camera with the cutting as well. Did you notice that towards the end? You know, because it's three stories first of all, because you've got Harry and Marion. Then then it becomes four when Harry and Tyrone get split up. Do you notice they cut between the stories more and more, like more and more intensely? Like the time for each story gets less and less, because it just everything ramps up, doesn't it?
That's where the cutting comes in, the fast editing.
Oh my God. I was thinking actually that, what was that film last year about the multiverse? Everything Everywhere at Once or something?
Yes, won the Oscar.
Yeah, I watched a bit of that and I thought, oh, they must have taken quite a bit from this. Just that really, really disorientating cutting, like dizzying kind of cutting. Yes, very good.
Anybody want to finish off with anything else?
Oh, I've got loads. Jennifer Connelly. That's a good name, isn't it?
It's easy for you to say.
Jennifer Connelly was in Once Upon a Time in America, wasn't she? She was the child.
Very, very young.
Yes.
Not the highlight of her career, though. I mean, that was Labyrinth.
I haven't seen that.
David Bowie, King of the Goblins.
Right, I'm changing my pick for the next film then. If you want
Yes. Good.
I think there was actually a credit for, it wasn't Puppeteer, but it was something like Refrigerator Wrangler or something that was going up on the credits. The people that are actually in charge of that prop got a very special mention, I did notice.
Did we say the author of the book, we said that, didn't we? He's the main racist guard.
Yes, I didn't notice that. Obviously, I didn't know what he looked like, but I spotted his name in the credits at the end.
What about the withdrawal scenes as well? It's like, oh, God. I think that was a comparable in quality to Trainspotting, but different, wasn't it?
Yeah, the way they work him in the prison. And because he hasn't had a chance to shine throughout this movie, I think, the Tyrone character, until this point. And that really sort of drums it home, the fact that it was an amazing little sequence for about 90 seconds where he's got this big thing and he's stirring something. And it's obviously being quite ill while he's doing, you know, you could see the withdrawal. And it's around about the same point, just as Burstyn's going in for the electric shock treatment, and Leto's going in to have the operation, and Jennifer Connelly is going into the party.
Yeah.
It's just, and you've got all four of these things hitting you from four angles, and it's like, my brain can't take this. Yeah. What am I supposed to think here? You know, just go with it. That's all you could do is just go with it. And it was a very satisfying sort of feeling coming out the other side of it, because you just have to take a deep breath and go, wow,
that was something.
What did I just watch there?
But the idea of having I think this film was quite interesting in the idea of having people of different ages addicted to drugs as well, because if you think about it, most drug films would probably be younger people, and then when it's when it's alcohol, it's often older people, like a
middle-aged man. Read about that in the trivia, that Darren Aronofsky wanted it to be sort of mid-teens, and he was pushed out of doing that by the producers, who felt it'd be too controversial and wouldn't get the cinema exposure, not just the ratings it would get from the but also it wouldn't get as many theatres actually showing it. Different attitudes, obviously, in different parts of the world, because there's a German film where there's like a 14-year-old girl that gets Christine. That's it. And that's a much younger person is involved in it. And, you know, it's one of a handful of films that does investigate addiction and drug use and etc. I mean, there was what's the one with Al Pacino that was in the 70s?
Panic in Needle Park.
So there's a variety in there. You know, it's a subgenre in some ways itself, but I think this does its although there are comparisons to Trainspotting and elsewhere. I think it might be that there would have been more differences if he'd been given more ability to be able to do what he wanted than the few bits that the studio or the producers, you know, hemmed him in on. So that, with regards to the ages, I think was fortunate in some respects, because it wouldn't have been necessarily Jennifer Connelly and Jared Leto. They'd probably have had to get some younger cast members as well.
Yeah.
They'll probably got we've probably got a better deal out of that than we might have done.
Yeah. Oh, definitely, yeah.
I've just found confirmation, Stephen, about what you said about the movie being timeless. Aronofsky wanted the film to be timeless. It should be about addiction, regardless of the time period in which it actually takes place. Mm. He said, ultimately, Requiem for a Dream is about the lengths people go to escape their reality, and that when you escape that reality, you create a hole in your present because you're not there.
There you go.
You're chasing off a pipe dream in the future, and then you'll use anything to fill that vacuum. He explained the film is about addiction to anything, not just illegal drugs. It could be coffee, TV, or even hope.
Oh, addicted to hope. Like it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all kind of addictions around, aren't there? Sugar, processed sugar in particular. You know, tobacco.
Scott's got his Angel Delight addiction.
Well, Alan Partridge was Toblerone, wasn't it? They said, you're addicted to Chocobot. Yeah, specifically Toblerone. I drove to Dundee in my bare feet. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, right. Yeah. Actually, I think the studio pressed for a happy ending. I can't imagine.
You're kidding.
Well, you know, they probably, I don't know how happy they wanted him to make it. But as I said earlier, in a weird way, they kind of got their wish in that the very last shots, you know, they have got smiles on their faces. Even though, so I suppose if you're at the cinema and you're not going to look into it that deeply, you could say, well, on the surface, you know, I got something. But yeah, pushing for a happy ending. I mean, they're probably always going to do that, aren't they? A Hollywood ending. How would that have worked? They could have woken up from a dream, couldn't they? Ah, it was all a dream.
It was all a dream, and there's Bobby Ewan in the shower.
Oh, that's a reference that will go over a lot of the audience's heads.
Yeah, there's probably quite a few happy endings in the party scene.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, do you know what? No, if they had tried to change this in any way, it would not have got the acclaim that it's so rightly deserved over the years. And is this film talked about in the way that we're talking about it today? Because there wasn't anything particularly around about 2000, 2001, in my mind, that was better in any sort of degree. You know, this is about the era of Gladiator and Erin Brockovich, as we said.
Well, I think visually you could probably say The Matrix. Obviously, it's nothing, subject matter is not the same. But that had, I don't know, that late 90s, early 2000s, pushing editing forward, I think, a bit, maybe. I'm not mad on The Matrix. I like the allegory more than the film, but...
Okay, that's Requiem for a Dream. Let's leave that there, guys. I'm not sure whose choice it is next time. Does anybody want to put their hand up? I don't think it's me.
Maybe it's me again.
I think if I remember correctly, this was Anthony and yours was...
I think I did Night to Remember.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a quick break and we're going to be back. We think it might be Stephen's choice. We're going to thrash this out. No, I can't say that because I've just got Jennifer Connelly in my brain there. We're going to thrash this out. We'll be back in a minute.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
Okay, so that was Requiem for a Dream, a very, very welcome choice from Anthony this month. I was expecting me to hate you for this and say, for putting me through this particular, because I was, just really, not nervous, but I was just like, God, it's going to be a depressing movie. And it was it was depressing. But at the same time, I came out of it uplifted in a way for having watched such a brilliant piece of cinema.
Yeah, sometimes you can just say, oh, that was a piece of, what a piece of work that was. And if you compare it, well, one more comparison to Irreversible, that's just impossibly bleak. I mean, okay, this goes wrong at the end, but there's at least they're talking about hope. At least hope is there somewhere, even if it's dashed. Yeah.
Yeah, it's constant throughout. Yeah, and then the last 20 minutes, no chance at all. Yeah. So we've decided that it must be Stephen's turn to choose the next movie when the three of us get together on Stinking Paws. So you've got a little list there, not as extensive as your Real Britannia list, mate. What are you thinking of next time?
Well, it's just a bit of a look at the lives of some people who are living above a butcher's shop.
Is it French, perchance?
It is French, yeah.
I love this film.
It's also been described as a post-apocalyptic surrealist black comedy.
Anthony, have you got any idea what it is?
No. Is it the same director who made Amelie or not?
I haven't
seen it, but I think you mentioned it when you did Amelie.
It's Junior and Caro, isn't it? It's the two directors in this.
So for the dear listener, it's Delicatessen from 1991.
I love that film. I absolutely adore this film. Well done, sir. I'm looking forward to that one. Have you seen it?
I've seen it once, but I literally don't remember any of it. I remember one scene, but that's it. Yeah.
Well, it set me on the track record of this and then City of Lost Children, and then Amelie, and then a very long engagement, and which are all worthwhile films. But
didn't he direct one of the Alien movies as well? Three.
Yeah, Alien 3. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I love that. I love the fact that we've gone from Requiem for a Dream. Well, actually, we've gone from Night to Remember to Requiem for a Dream to Delicatessen.
Love it. Yeah.
That's a night's entertainment of
eclectic
you use it,
yeah. Well, we say at Real Britannia you go all the way from The Third Man to Confessions of a Driving Instructor. So you've got range.
Yeah. That's the only thing we've got. That's the only thing that's propping us up, mate, at the moment.
And good guests.
It's down to you two, exactly.
Good guests is the other thing we have on Real Britannia.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Stinking Paws podcast. Before we go, I will thank Stephen for his hearty contribution today. Thank you, mate.
No problem. Happy to be here.
And before we go, Anthony, would you like to remind our one listener where he or she can find you?
Oh, yes. Glass Onion on John Lennon. Deep dive into John Lennon. Lots of different topics branching off from him. That's how I've kept it going for 4.5 years now. Ridiculous. I haven't even reviewed any of his albums, hardly. of the five or six he made a solo. Anyway, yes, Life and Life Only is psychology and alternative media, and Film Gold. Maybe doing a deep dive into Requiem for a Dream now. I'm thinking, you know, like majorly branching off from what's in this film. But that could be on Film Gold, but yeah. I just posted our talk about Moosin and a Bounty.
All right, yeah. Okay. Yes, no, I saw it? That. Yeah.
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 Yeah, it was very good.
I enjoyed that one.
Yeah, when we were talking about casting, right at the end, Stephen's talking about how they could do Moosin and a Bounty Netflix with Danny Dyer. That's very funny.
Danny Dyer.
Yeah, what I bring to these reviews is incomparable.
No, that was brilliant. Obviously, you were joking, but maybe not.
Didn't Stephen suggest Sid James as the iceberg in Night to Remember as well?
It's a chance for me to
see. I can't remember the reason why. Why was it Sid James as an iceberg? Something to do with cracking up or something, wasn't it?
Possibly. Yeah. Don't try and work out how my brain works, because I don't know.
Well, since we mentioned Carry On, I imagine every film we review now, how could it be done as a Carry On? Yeah. Like I said, Carry On Requiem.
Carry On Delicatessen is going to be, yeah.
Well, this one, Carry On Up the Trump.
Oh, God.
And on that note, this has been A Stinking Pause. Thank you, guys. I'll see you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
The management of this theater suggests that for the greater entertainment of your friends who have not yet seen the picture, you will not divulge to anyone the secret of the ending.
Astrid Arms, that infernal jamboree is worse than two cats on a fence.
You dudes get lost now, you hear?
Good night, ladies.
Good night, sir.
When you feel down, try positive thinking. That's what I told the man, said, don't wear a frown, try positive thinking, laugh at your troubles instead. You've got to look on the bright side, on hope so much depends. With your confidence sinking, positive thinking helps you on the way, my friend. When things look black, try positive thinking, treat every season as spring. No glancing back, try positive thinking, trust what tomorrow may bring. This crazy world that we live in will keep on spinning round, but with good, strong, positive thinking, we'll get together and life won't let us down.
Shut up, ugly bitch.
Oh, shut up. We enjoy it.